I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. It's always delightful to have Mike McArdle on this program. He's got a new book out, Everything Works. It's a collection of pieces like the ones he presents at the end of the top-rated news hour on Global BC. After the scandals, political intrigue, and crime stories they present on their broadcast, Mr. McArdle comes on at the end with his light-hearted, often amusing, sometimes heart-rending pieces that more often than not remind us that life's pretty good, and yes, everything works. The book is published by Harbor. GlobalTVBC.com is the website where you can see a lot of Mike's pieces. As always, proceeds from sales of these books will go to the Variety Club. His five previous books have raised some $70,000 for Variety previously. Please welcome back to the Plante on the Line program, Mike McArdle. Good morning, Mr. McArdle.
Thank you very much. How are you?
Very good. Yourself?
Fine.
Yeah. In the book, there's a series of pieces on you in the hospital. How long ago was that?
That was April. This is December, so it's that long ago. And holy miracle, it's very funny because I totally believe if you want to be healthy, you just tell yourself you're healthy. And since I've been doing that since I met Riley, the little autistic kid, about 7, 8, or maybe 9 years ago, I really haven't been sick. Totally not sick. I haven't taken any Tylenol. And, you know, I get up feeling crummy some mornings. I say, I'll be okay. And within a reasonable time, I'm okay. That does not apply to having something go wrong in the middle of your stomach and almost dying. That was a twisted bowel. And that happens, pardon me for going on about this, but that happens routinely, I learned, to cows and horses and dogs, except they can't complain about it, and they die of it immediately. Something just screws up inside you, and your large bowels get twisted up, and nothing goes through them. Then they explode, and you can figure out what happens after that.
Yeah.
It also will apply to a frog in my throat. But one of the Bee Gees, I was told while I was in the hospital, one of the Bee Gees, the singing group, you know, about 5 or 6 years ago, Maurice Gibb, died of the same thing. He was just an hour or so behind me getting to a hospital. And so I went in the hospital with this incredible pain in my stomach, one of those worst pains you've ever had in your life. And about 4 hours later, I was in the operating room, and they took it all out, the bowel. But that gave me a chance to write stories.
Yeah, and everything's fine now, right?
Everything is totally fine.
Yeah. The time that you're, I guess, on sick bed, I mean, does that give you perspective? I mean...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the two... the most touching thing of all was, and this is one of the stories in the book, you lose track of time after you're completely... unconscious and cut open and sewed up and all that sort of stuff, but everybody knows that now hospitals get you out of a bed just as quickly as they can, so because they try to get you walking, and that's good for your recovery. But so I was probably day three, and I'm walking down the hallway, a corridor in the hospital, what they've told me to do, and everybody's doing it, and I have this pole with half a dozen bottles of stuff dripping into me, and another bag of stuff dripping out of me, and I haven't shaved, I haven't washed, I haven't combed my hair, I've got a hospital gown on that's got a button that's not snapped at the top, and I'm completely lost. Like, I can't figure out how to get my left foot around in front of my right foot so I can take a step. And I realized that all the people that I've done stories about, and that you and everyone has seen at bus stops, that are little old ladies and little old men that just sit there and the tie is on wrong, or you can see the lipstick isn't done right, and they sit, and a bus comes in, and a bus goes away, and they can't realize that they have to get up and get onto the bus. And it breaks your heart to see them. And they haven't gotten there through any fault of their own. They're not Lean and Hastings. They're not bad people. They're just they're just wearing out. And I had gotten there in 3 days, all by myself. And I got to the end of the hallway, and I can't figure out how to snap this button together. I put down my bag of urine pee that I'm holding in one hand, and I still can't figure it out. And somebody comes along, a nurse, I guess, because I couldn't even see, and buttons it for me. And that was the nicest thing anybody could possibly do for me. I felt wonderful, even though I still could barely figure out which way it was back to the room I was in. And so I got thinking later that when we see those little old men, little old ladies at bus stops or in grocery stores or something like that, and you stop, you don't have to get in a conversation with them, but if she's a woman staring at a can of soup on the shelf, you say, "Can I get that for you?"
Yeah.
You could make the whole world a lot better place.
Yeah.
And not do, you know, and do nothing else except that.
Right. Harold is...
Oh, Harold, yes.
Yeah, you've talked about him in previous books and
yeah.
The times we've talked before. How old is he now?
He's 91.
91. He doesn't ride the motorcycle, right?
No. He's coming to our house tomorrow.
Oh, is that right?
For dinner. I've invited him, and he said he called me back and said he may have trouble getting up the steps. And I said, well, we'll figure out a way. We'll get you inside a different way. And he was greatly happy about that.
Yeah. That's one thing in the book that you talk about, that not only should we help them get a can off a shelf at a grocery store, we should ask them about their childhood, right?
Oh, yeah.
Older people.
Yeah, if you do that, you get two things. You learn about them. The greatest stories, the only stories, are your life. You, Joseph, you know, what you've seen and known, you who are listening to this, your own, what you saw, what you remember from your childhood, how that made you, how you made others, how you got along with your mother and father or didn't, or whatever, it doesn't matter. The stories are the only stories we have. And when I was in the coffee, well, I meet him every Tuesday, but I see when he tells me stories, like the one that's in the book, but hundreds of other ones like this, when they were kids, and this is before the Depression, okay? That's a while ago.
Yeah.
They would take a little boat out, basically a rowboat with a, I don't know if it was a 2 or 3 horsepower motor, and get to the middle of Georgia Strait, and there would be a tug going by, a towboat with a log boom behind it. And if they could catch up to that, they could hook on the back of the log boom, climb onto it, and camp out there for a while and wave to the people on the boat. And he told me about one time that they had a little fire on the back of the boat, back of the logs, a campfire, and they put they brought some bacon because they were going to go to one of the islands and cooked bacon on it while the well, the coastline is going by, and I'm looking at him. He's looking at me, or he's looking at the people in the Tim Hortons, but he's not seeing me. He's seeing the boat going by, and that's the other thing about this. That's relativity, at least to me. That's what Einstein talked about, but this time I understand it. He was not in this year. He was in the year when he was 10 years old, and he was right there then, and he took me along for the ride. I could see 80 years just vanish. That's magic, and it's also real.
Yeah. You have 2 grandkids now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you get the book, you can see the picture on the inside back flap.
That's right, yeah. Now, do you tell them stories about your childhood?
The older one, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Well, I told him I'm still at the point where the stories of my childhood are the time that I went to the moon and I brought back moon rocks. That's the same story that I told to my kids. And for a couple of years, they believed it until they became wiser. And now my daughter is telling her daughter that my trip to the moon might not actually be just the way I'm telling it. And, So we have a tug of truth there going on.
Yeah. The other thing about Harold, you mentioned that you guys meet every Tuesday at the Tim Hortons, right?
Right.
You bring your own corn muffins.
Well, not every week, but yeah. I bring as often as I can get up early enough to cook him corn muffins, and he buys me coffee, and so I sneak the muffins into Tim Hortons, which I'm sure is against their rules, and then we go up and we get some butter from the counter,
yeah.
and so... Yeah, we have a good time.
Yeah, the other thing that I struck me and just heartened me is that you and your wife, you use the public library still.
Oh, well, yeah, partly because 100% because when I met her, she was an addicted library goer and has never changed. But she's also a preschool teacher, so we go to various libraries at least twice a week, sometimes three times or four times a week, and borrow countless little picture books, and she keeps handing them to me, say, read this, is this good, or read that, and tell me if that's good, and there's a whole bunch that aren't good. Those are the ones I figured out are written by committees or politically correct people to prove something or other, and they get published because they prove that whatever it is they're proving, and they don't have a story. And other ones that do have stories about the pink alligator crossing the road to get away from the green monster or to catch up to the pretty blue alligator, they're just so touching and so direct that even I can follow them. And I read that and say, that's what a story is. Something happens. Something neat with a problem, with an obstacle in between the first and the last page, and the pink alligator has overcome it somehow. Well, so I try to do television stories just like that.
Do you think kids would read your books?
Some do, I'm told.
Yeah.
Most of all, I'm happy. I wish I could answer that and say yes, they
yeah,
do.
Yeah.
But what I'm happy about is when I a lot of adults tell me they're buying the books for the teenage kids who don't read and don't like books and, you know, that sort of stuff. And everyone, because they're all complimentary to me because they're telling me the story, which is nice, but they say their teenagers start reading those books and they love them. And then they go on and they read another one and another one, well, another story in it, and then, you know, they finish one book and they get a second book and they tell me, these are the parents, that the books have turned their kids on to reading. Well, I'm happy about that.
Yeah, and I guess it comes from the fact that they see you on TV, they know you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that draws in the initial thing, but the stories have to be good enough to get them to read a second one.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, it's tough to read 700 words.
I've asked you before about how you put these pieces together on the TV. It's still a full-time job for you, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
A couple of days ago, we're full-time. You mean 8 hours a day or 5 days a week?
Yeah.
Both cases, yes.
Both, yeah.
10 hours a day sometimes. There was a story last week where cameraman stops at a Starbucks and asks me to, if he says he'll get me a coffee if I wait in his van so that he doesn't have to put money into the meter. Okay, that's a fair trade. I spend nothing and he gets me a coffee.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking in the front window of the Starbucks and I see this kid who's about 5 or 6, something like that, and there's a guy in Starbucks and almost looks like his father, because they're the same race and the same face, and he's bringing the kid a smoothie and a bagel, and I just got the idea maybe that's the employee's kid, and I go inside and they're very friendly, and he tells me, so you notice I have abandoned the van. He tells me that he couldn't get a babysitter this morning, so he brought his kid to work for a couple of hours, and so the kid was getting hot chocolate and cookies and all every, you know, basically anything. It was an open treat for him. and everybody was happy to have him there. I asked if we could take a picture of him, and, well, he said, yes, of course. And I said, are you sure? And because we've got rules here. He says, he's the supervisor of the thing. And so cameraman still has not put money in the meter, but gets his camera, and we talk to the kid, and he's precocious. He insists he's 8 years old when his father says, no, you're really five. And and they have a father-son discussion about his age, and that alone is funny enough. And then the kid gets into a discussion with one of the other employees about his age, and everybody has a happy time. And as we're leaving, the father comes out of the back. He says he has just learned that we're not allowed to be in there. Oh, well, let me talk to the supervisor, you know, by telephone. So I start with the local one in Vancouver, then I move up to somebody in Toronto, then I move up to somebody in Seattle, then I swear I moved up to the corporate headquarters on Mars. And they're all nice, and this is nothing negative about Starbucks, but their corporate policy is we can't take pictures in there no matter what, even if we got permission. And I know we could just go ahead and use it because we weren't told not to until we were leaving. But on the other hand, I'm not going to get that father into trouble. Just because that's not what I, you know, you don't hurt anybody. That's my basic, one of my basic two premises. You don't hurt anybody, and you do help people if you can. So we're not going to use that story at all. But it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon now.
Yes.
And this is a day last week when the rain, well, there wasn't rain. It was just the entire Pacific Ocean coming down on our heads. And there's nobody out. And the cameraman says, it's dark.
Yeah.
And I have to have a story because I haven't failed in years, not since I met Riley. Just believe you can find it. We can find it somewhere. The cameraman knows this one Salvation Army woman who stands out just at the edge, in the rain, just at the edge of an overhang, and she's in Burnaby, and he knows where she is at a strip mall, and we go there, and she's not there. And he's run out of gas now, so we have to get gas, and that's taking up more time. And I'm looking around the gas station, and then he says, we got to get out of the rain. We just can't. And I'm thinking, if we find somebody in the rain, even though it's dark, that'll make a good story, because why would that person be out in the rain? And we won't find anybody because it's raining incredibly hard. And he says, let's go try Burnaby Lake. And anybody there doing anything? There's nobody there doing nothing. Well, half a block away is 8 rinks, and we go there. And to me, the worst picture is people skating. It's there's nothing wrong with skating.
Yeah.
Hockey, it's beautiful to watch, but on television, unless you're doing a hockey game, the colors and it just all looks the same, at least to me. And so we go inside, we leave the skating rink. I say, go up by the cafeteria. There might be a lady there who's worked there forever and ever, or is wearing a Santa Claus hat or something. Well, the cafeteria is closing. So I look over on the side, and there's a little boy spinning tops on the ground. Oh, thank you. So we talk to the little boy. We can't spin the tops very well. But I look around, and there's a room full of mostly mothers, and their son is sitting by the window watching their girls, mostly girls, learning figure skating down below. Ah, those who wait. It's now 4:45. Those who wait. And we quickly talk to, and the mothers are, they're very patient, understanding. Some of them are funny. Some of them, I've read half a library while sitting there, you know, over the years. Many of them spend 3 or 4 hours a day, 5 days a week, with various kids, just waiting. Ah, the story of waiting, the story of patience, the story of love and dedication. It was about 4:45. 5:30, 4:45 when we left there. 6:15 when I got back to the TV station. Luckily, it's not too far away. 6:55 when the story of waiting was on the air.
Yeah.
So is it a full-time job? Not kidding.
Yeah. The you've been involved in the station's been doing these retrospectives on the 50th anniversary of the station.
Yeah.
That must be fun to look back at.
It was great.
Yeah.
It was super great. That's all. It was super great. It was. I got a headache though one day because I'm just sitting there for 8 hours a day staring at monitors and saying, "Oh, that's no good. That's not funny. That I can't remember that. In fact, nobody can remember that. I don't know why we saved that."
Yeah.
How about that other thing that everybody remembers? Wait a minute, we can't find that. That wasn't saved.
Yeah.
But we did one solid month of quite long stories, like 3.5 or 4.5 minutes, which is long for television. And worked with an editor named Ron Tupper, who wears shorts all year round, even in the winter, and. We sat in a room together. That's bonding.
Yeah.
For a month with the door closed and sometimes people could hear us yelling at each other in the hallway. But it was that was all funny yelling.
You write about the people that you work with at the station.
Mm-hmm.
You tell us about some of the names that we'd recognize at home.
Well, the names in the. The sad way that television and movies and stuff like that works is only the people who you see and you get to know really mean something to you. The people who help me the most, help me entirely, are the ones you don't see. Those are the camera folks and the editors and the producers and the ones doing the lineups and the other people. I've written about them constantly from the first book. But the ones that you do see, like Brian Coxford, now he's been around, he's the only one around the TV station longer than me. And he was there a year or two before I got there, and I got there in 1976. Now, this guy is the nattiest, not natty, I never use that word, he's the neatest dresser in the entire television. Well, he's the best dresser probably in British Columbia. I mean, he will pick out his clothes so carefully. He'll spend hours. I asked him once if you were rushing off to a forest fire or a big crime somewhere, because he does all kinds of news, you know, what would be the first thing that you would think of? And I'm thinking, you know, would he go to a local newspaper? Would he try to get into the fire? He says, choosing the right clothes to take. But you got a flipping forest fire. Well, I don't want to, you know, wear my best clothes. I want to look like I belong there, and I don't want to look too good, and I don't want to look too bad. That's him. But every day, every single day, he has another story that runs at the top of the show, and every single day for more than 35 years, he comes in, he spends so much time getting the story that it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon before he shows up at work. And everybody says, you can't make it, you can't get it edited, you can't get it written in an hour. And every single day he does.
Yeah.
And John Daly, there's a total nutcase. He sit right next to him, and I did one story once about his desk, which is one of those classic things where you can't find the desk because he has so many notes and stuff, just stuff, from plastic forks from the cafeteria to awards he's gotten. Each of those treated equally, just piled up. But he's driven. The cameramen say, you know, just to be with him, he's like a cat inside their vans or their trucks or whatever they're driving, and he's hanging from the inside the ceiling, inside roof, upside down, saying, go, go!
Yeah.
And Darlene Heidemann, she's super cool. She used to be, before she became a reporter, she was a cook in a logging camp, a forestry camp. I think it was also tree planting, but anyhow, she used a shotgun to protect her camp from bears and wild animals. No, she never shot a bear. But you're talking about a tough woman. And one time, I know she told me a story. I, This is not in the book I wrote. Maybe it is, because I wrote this story for a magazine once about her, an outdoors magazine, how her little brother came to spend some time with her while she was at the logging camp, and he lost all his fishing hooks from mountain pike, and she got so mad at the fish and wanted to protect her little brother, she ran into the creek and chased the fish down with her hands and the feet, and caught it and gave it to her brother. And now, then she also does all the crime stories that that John Daly doesn't do. But right. She was the main one on the Picton thing, and that was, you know, horrendously horrible, miserable, gut-turning kind of stories. That's just the stories. Imagine being there.
Yeah.
But she had one of her new kid, then new baby, and she would bring the boy to work and put him down on a blanket and with some toys to play with while on the floor next to her while she was writing these stories. And I'm thinking, now there's, you know, there's no moral to that. I mean, you're just looking at a woman writing about horrid death and torturing while her most precious one in the world is playing at her feet. How do you do that?
Yeah.
And, you know, you give her a lot of credit. And someday her, this I said in the books, someday her kids, she's got two of them, are going to say, Mom, you know, when they're 13, Mom, you just don't understand us. You don't understand what we're going through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The ratings still, I mean, you've changed anchors now at the...
the ratings have gotten better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's still fun to do for you.
Oh, yeah. That's why I didn't retire.
Yeah.
I mean, I was lucky. Well, that's going away now, the mandatory retirement thing. I heard it's going away. But 2 years ago when I was 65, I had to retire according to their federally licensed laws. And but they were kind enough to give me an extended contract, so I'll be there for another year or two or however long I can do it, because I simply love it. It's just so neat to go out and look for something, and so look for something good and tell it at the end of the day.
Congratulations on this book. It's a great read, as always. All your books are.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed the conversation. Happy Christmas, Mike, to you and your
Merry
family.
Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you.
And to everyone.
Thank you. The book is called Everything Works, from Harbor Publishing. It's author Mike McArdle on the line. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.